Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
In this episode of Lost River Legends, we talk about the Electric Universe Theory. The Electric Universe Theory holds that there is a relationship between the Sun, the planets, and perhaps the lesser Sun we know as Saturn. The relationship between these planets is electric versus gravity-based. Anciently, Earth would have been a very different place to live during this time frame and is referred to as the Golden Age. Understanding the origins and mythologies and man's relationship with the ancient sky has much more meaning when understood through the lens of an electric universe model. There would have been different shapes of plasma discharges emanating from heavenly bodies, and these heavenly bodies became deities, marks of the season, or even harbingers of destruction. Here at Lost River Legends, we reached out and have developed a good relationship with Michael Armstrong. He is a key member of the Thunderbolts Project. In the project's infancy, he was at the crossroads and rubbed shoulders with Anthony Peratt, David Talbot, Wal Thornhill, and others. He is a major proponent of the Saturnian Reconstruction Movement, which acknowledges an alternative cosmology of a polar configuration of Saturn, Venus, and Mars. Some of the theories held by Velikovsky in Worlds in Collision have been supported by additional research from Wal Thornhill and others. Michael Armstrong is an original member of the Thunderbolts.info editorial staff and has a formal science background in chemistry. He has studied the catastrophism reconstruction model for over 40 years and has lectured on the catastrophism material in an international conference sponsored by the province of Milano, Italy, and hosted by the University of Milano, Bergamo. Michael is a producer of various related video material and publisher of the books Thunderbolts of the God, The Electric Sky, and The Electric Universe. Michael currently spends his time pondering the bigger questions about who we are in the universe and how do we find peace and understanding in this chaotic world. His passion is philosophical and spiritual in nature. You can find his work on the subject at ificu.com. He also runs Micomar Publishing, which can be found at micomar.biz. Welcome to Michael Armstrong in this latest episode of Lost River Legends. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, today we are joined by Michael Armstrong. He is joining us from the Portland area in Oregon, and we're very, very pleased to have him on. We've gotten to know him pretty well and some of the things that drive and motivate him. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael. How are you?
Well, you're welcome, and I'm reasonably well, considering the greater human condition.
Right, right, and that's something that we've talked about, and we could actually talk about that another day in the grand scheme of things, because it is an important subject. It's important to understand what that means. So, Michael, with your background and some of the areas that you've researched in your life and some of the colleagues that you've had and the shoulders that you've rubbed against, you have a great understanding of this electric universe model, and that's what we're really wanting to get into today. And we've prepared some questions for you so that you'd be on your toes just as much as I'm trying to be. So,
all right,
I'd love to get into that with you. So my first question for you would be, Can you describe the origins of the electric universe model in connection to Velikovsky, and how has it evolved to where it is today?
Okay, well, let me see. I think I need to break that down into two parts. The first part terms of the origins of the electric universe model in conjunction with Velikovsky. Electric universe concepts preceded Velikovsky. In fact, some of the ancients understood the electrical nature of the universe to a degree. We have Heraclitus saying, quote, "It is the thunderbolt that steers the universe." Velikovsky was an intellectual giant, and he was an internationally known scholar at the time, and his father founded the university at Tel Aviv, but he didn't particularly understand very much about the electric universe until he hooked up with the electrical engineer Ralph Jurgens. I would say that Jurgens and Velikovsky were both giants in terms of integrating things, integrating widely diverse information to recover a picture of what has happened or is happening. And they had a synergistic effect working together. At some point, Velikovsky wrote a very significant article called Cosmos Without Gravitation, which suggested that the force of gravity was actually an electrical effect. Now, Jurgens had the foundation of practical electrical engineering training and knowledge, and he had the genius to see that it was readily applicable to what Velikovsky was proposing about planetary catastrophe in ancient times. Most of their thinking is covered in Velikovsky's books, and especially for Jurgens, in many articles in the Ponce journals, in the Kronos journals that were published during that time period. Now, this all took place in an era where the so-called standard model of solar internal nuclear fusion came under scrutiny and assault because of many anomalies and inconsistencies in the thread of phenomena or understanding the phenomena that it takes to deliver energy to the surface of the sun from a distant core located fusion process. Not to mention that virtually all of the visible phenomena of the sun are electrical or plasma phenomena. The magnetic poles, the corona, the arcing, sunspots, the various double layers defining the various solar spherical shells, proton storms, particles accelerating against the gravitational field. We would assume that the solar wind, as thrown off by the sun, would normally slow down as it progresses away, but that isn't the case. The solar wind accelerates away from the sun. Isn't that significant?
I would think so, and that's not something that I've heard. I don't know if it's right. Being widely discussed, if not at all.
Well, it's a significant fact, and it ought to be discussed. It ought to be answered sufficiently, and I think only the electric universe can give us an answer to that.
Well, that's awesome. I really appreciate where you're coming from on that and how you broke that down for us. As far as how has that model evolved from Velikovsky to what we understand today?
First of all, Jurgens continued to push the envelope significantly. Several other men made substantial contributions. Earlier ones that come to mind are Eric Crewe, C.E.R. Bruce, C.J. Ransom, Earl Milton, and others. Some later ones are Donald Scott, professor of electrical engineering and author of The Electric Sky, Tom Van Flandern. Halton Arp made a huge contribution with his cosmological findings, his double-lobed shape of the physical universe, and especially his work regarding redshift and quasar origins and behavior. Now, Anthony Peratt was a student of Nobel Prize-winning Hannes Alfvén, who developed his own plasma cosmology. Peratt was convinced of what he called the plasma universe, or what we call the electric universe. Peratt became a major influence in the IEEE and became a co-director of Los Alamos National Laboratories, where he had a security clearance for the top secret material regarding nuclear fusion and fusion weapons and so on. Peratt was convinced of what he called the plasma universe, and as such, he became arguably the world's preeminent authority on plasma cosmology. He got his head into the catastrophism paradigm suggested by Velikovsky and Talbot, and made huge contributions in terms of understanding petroglyphs and petrographs. Understand that Los Alamos Labs is located in the middle of petrograph country, and there's no area in the world greater for petroglyphs and petrographs than down there. And Peratt had access to the entire restricted area and took advantage of it. He was an outdoorsman and comfortable in, you know, a wilderness setting. So he indulged himself in many field trips and applied his prodigious knowledge and intellect to make significant observations as to petrograph location, orientation, and especially their being situated where the artist was protected from ionizing synchrotron radiation coming from over the South Pole. He had made a specialty of documenting the phenomena in the lab when plasma currents break down and form distinctive shapes. These are called Peratt instability. He was the world's expert on what happened when plasma currents break down. He recognized these plasma instabilities, their forms, as being portrayed in the petroglyphs and interpreted them as being reproductions of huge plasma structures seen in the sky by the ancients. Now, electric universe plasma cosmology has long since developed to the point where it has been acknowledged as a legitimate field of study by the American Physical Society and the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, Plasma Science Division of the IEEE. And yet this new and important branch of astrophysics receives little attention in the mainstream press even today. The man that has taken the EU paradigm furthermost is my Australian colleague Wallace Thornhill, co-author of the Electric Universe book. He has significantly revised physical theory from the lowest level of particle physics to the highest level of cosmology and astrophysics, including everything in between. Believe me, that revision is more extensive than most thought possible. It has implications that touch all of the scientific disciplines, including the development of life forms. An elegant, grand, unified theory is the result of Thornhill's thinking. I may be the one person that supports almost all of his thinking. Now, by way of context, when Thornhill came over here to the U.S., pretty much on an annual basis, I scheduled an annual four-day weekend meeting at my house where the principals stayed at my house during that time, and a couple of other locations with friends of mine. And we would get together and sit in a circle, generally in my living room or backyard, weather permitting, and discuss all the scientific issues. Where the electric universe movement was, where it was going, and what to do about it. At one of the weekend meetings, Peratt made a game-changing presentation to us on the correlation between the ancient forms depicted in the sky and in the petroglyphs and petroglyphs, and he recognized that these were Peratt instabilities. Thornhill's ideas challenge both of the, quote, successful but mathematically mystical paradigms of relativity and quantum mechanics, which I refer to as quantum mystics. Let me ask you a question. If science today claims something that is opposed to what the religious community believes, who wins? Who prevails?
Well, in today's atmosphere, certainly science has the upper hand as far as
right,
support.
Right.
Yeah.
All the religious ideas have to take second place or conform to what science tells us, which makes scientism the prevailing dominant religion of today that actually has marginalized all other religions. In our society, with this new dominant religion, a huge misconception holds sway, that being that mathematics is definitive in defining or deciding physical theory. Not true. Mathematics is a language, and like any language, it can be used to lie to us, to describe a falsity or a myth. The EU deals with the complete spectrum of physical phenomena that we have available to us to study. For instance, geological formations, craters and rills, river valleys, mountain chains and ridges, canyons, the Grand Canyon, the largest canyon system in the world is just south of our border in Mexico. Then we have the Marineris Valley on Mars. We have mineral deposits piled up around the world, seemingly the result of cascades of material from the sky. We have Antarctic anomalies. The ice down in Antarctic is almost pure. It's like distilled water, frozen distilled water. And it goes down a mile below sea level and a mile above sea level. Now, how do you get slow ice of deposition during winters to be pure and to wind up a mile below sea level.
Well, my
can
guess,
you visualize that?
Yeah, I mean, my guess would be cataclysm, something that happens quick.
Right, right. An ice dump from the sky, essentially, and that's what happened. We have also permafrost, fossils, fossilization, and element transmutation or element transmutation. Now, in terms of life forms, it has long been a mystery as to how water can be pulled up to the top of the world's tallest trees, over 200 feet. We know that water can only be sucked up 32 feet by a perfect vacuum before the column breaks. So how does it get up to over 200 feet in trees? Well, that accomplishment is no mystery in the EU paradigm, because we exist in a clear air field from ground to the overhead double layer of 100 or more volts per meter. The EU deals with cosmological structure. The double lobes of Fornax and our own, and the web sponge galactic formation that we find out there, the galactic structure, galactic mechanics, the fact that galaxies don't rotate like a bunch of individual particles of stars. They rotate like a bicycle wheel, like they're all tied together.
So you bring up you're bringing up some very interesting stuff when it comes to cosmological things, and I guess for our listeners, we need to lay a little bit of the groundwork for, I guess what we would call, the ancient sky involving Saturn, and kind of what the implications of that are within our own solar system.
Right. Well, that's a really complex subject. But very quickly, the idea is that, like we have today, many examples out in the universe of the astral bodies in the electrical environment sometimes form alignments. And these alignments are within a plasma cocoon. And so that's the idea behind the early history of mankind on the Earth, that we found ourselves inside of a plasma, a glowing plasma cocoon tunnel with Mars and Venus and Saturn overhead in that order, so that when we looked up, we saw what the ancients called the wheel within a wheel, the great, it looked like an eyeball. It looked like a fried egg in a frying pan. And the most distant object that we could see was the background of the planet Saturn. And so that was known as the deep. It was the deep because that was the deepest part of the tunnel that we could see. And we couldn't see out of the tunnel. We could not see the other stars and galaxies at that period of time. The theory is that at some point that cocoon of the Saturnian system spiraled in toward the solar system. And when it hit the heliopause of the solar system, it broke up, and the various planets, including the Earth, Venus, Mars, and Saturn, and maybe who knows how many moons, all found new orbits in the solar system.
And I think it's important to note that the orbits before were not planar the way that we understand our solar system to be more planar today.
Right. Absolutely. Completely different. of the Earth and Venus and Mars were in an alignment inside of a plasma cocoon.
So more like a stacked orientation in relation to each other.
Sure, and we have symbols of this artwork and architecture around the world that depicts various aspects of this. In the Orient, the temples, the original temple was basically an upside down version of what the ancient situation the Earth was in. And so the foundation of these pagodas or temples was, the original foundation was a golden globe with a pyramid up to a bluish-green sphere and another smaller, narrower pyramid up to a reddish-brown sphere representing Mars, and then a pyramid up to the Earth. They didn't include the last part because that was the view from the Earth. That was the great eye in the sky, the eye of God, always present,
right, and
omnipresent.
That actually, I was just looking that up, you know, because that actually makes way more sense in context. Think of planets within planets as far as the viewpoint, and then with a discharge coming off of it, it would look like an eye shining down on you. And then, of course, the, you know, what we'd refer to as a pyramid, you know, it used to be a mound, or the mound of Earth, you know, and that kind of being the primordial, you know, launching point for creation and for humankind.
Yeah, well, when you're looking up at a lengthy Birkeland current that is two entwined currents, and it looks like a stepped pyramid from the perspective of the Earth, so that the Birkeland current connections and discharges from Saturn to Venus and to Mars.
There's a structure that I think you were describing earlier as far as the different colors and stages to it. Is it called a tulpa? Is that the word?
That isn't... I'm having a memory problem with that one right now. That is close to the right term.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
Not exactly.
I think we discussed it before on our initial phone call, so... That's okay. I really appreciate what you've outlined for our listeners and the implications of this, and understanding how it actually does explain a lot of phenomenon in our past, but also current principles when applied to physics and electrogravitics and a lot of different fields, and it, like you said, it covers basically everything. Like, it can explain everything
right.
with that unified field theory, or what some people would call theory of everything, which, you know, Einstein was attempting. It'd be interesting to have some of those people in the same room, you know. So I guess what are some of the implications to that, the scientific community, if they actually were to apply the EU to their modeling and their experimentation?
Those implications are enormous. We would all of a sudden understand how to do cold fusion. We would understand how to do warm fusion. We would understand that there's a pathway to thermonuclear fusion through electric discharge and resonance, rather than using the brute force of pressure and try to contain thermonuclear fusion inside of a plasma bottle or whatever. We can't quite seem to make that work. but there are alternatives that are not being looked at or investigated. Consider the Sapphire Project. The Sapphire Project was set up to try to model the electrical phenomena of the sun. And the Sapphire Project has produced nuclear fusion. And that's as much as I know. I don't know where they're going to go with that. I don't know how practical the application is, but they have clearly induced nuclear fusion by lower levels of electrical activity.
You know, that project actually has had the attentions of myself and my close friends for a while. And, you know, seeing some of the evolution of that and some of the things that they've released with, you know, you had basically elements permutating within the chamber and basically taking on other forms from what they started out as.
Yes, indeed.
So the implication of that is huge. Do you know if what the current status is of the Sapphire Project? Has it been sold or bought, or is it being privatized? What's kind of the path there?
I do not, partly because of lack of interest. My interest is turned toward dealing with the ultimate issues that we face as human beings in a huge impersonal universe. So
yeah, I was curious on that.
I don't know where they're going with it, and I really don't care.
Sure. Well, and it's
that much.
It has profound implications that, you know, if you were to kind of extrapolate that out, I mean, we look at kind of there's this big electric vehicle movement. And the biggest challenge is capacitance, right? Having these cars have battery systems that have more ability to store energy and to be efficient. And you know, that's something that might actually, you know, down the road, 10, 15 years, when we have, you know, a bunch of cars in junkyards that are bleeding lithium, it could be an environmental nightmare. And, you know, is there ways around that with applying some of the electric universe principles?
I don't know that the battery technicians need to know much about the larger implications of the electric universe principles. With the ideal characteristics of being having a charge cycle from fully charged to almost completely discharged, and a recharging cycle that's good for more than 2,000 cycles. And this battery is relatively lightweight and relatively cheap. So it's going to revolutionize, you know, the automobile industry.
Well, and we're seeing a big push that direction. I'm thinking more along the lines of, you know, if you're saying cold fusion technically would be possible. I mean, it's a big leap from obviously where they're at. But I mean, you know, if the implication is extrapolated out that far, you know, could you have something self-sustaining versus...
Well, there are ways to accomplish fusion, because we know that animals and plants, obviously there's elemental transmutation taking place in certain plants and in eggs, for instance. I think it was Louis Kervran documented all of that, but that doesn't get very much attention. I don't think we know what to do with it.
Yeah, and I think...
Anyway.
Yeah, and we know that there's, you know, with a lot of the research research papers and research outlets, that there's a lot of favoritism and things like that. Kind of some, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That's been proven to exist. So weeding out stuff that doesn't sit well with people and their paradigms, I could see that being an issue. Speaking about paradigm, I guess that kind of segues me into the next subject that you've actually spoken on extensively. And you have, there's a couple of, I think you have a video or two on the Thunderbolts Project YouTube channel regarding time and how time is closely tied to physical events. And I'd like to hear that line of thought.
Okay. Well, one of the implications or foundational approaches of the EU model, at least in my mind, is that we have to stay faithful to axiomatic metaphysical principles. Two very foundational metaphysical principles are: there is no such thing as nothing. It's just a mathematical concept. You can't show me zero diamond rings or zero eggs, and you can't show me an infinite number of anything. And this is closely tied to what I think is absolutely always necessary in any valid scientific theory or thinking, and that is that what we are talking about must be visualized, not just mathematically modeled. If you can't visualize it, it isn't real, in other words. So how's that? Is that definitive enough for you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. When it comes to understanding time in relation to, say, cataclysmic events, or you know, that's on the grand scale, but on a smaller scale, you know, on a watch face, we have, you know, a hand moving position in relation to other hands or to other positions on the dial. Can you get into that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I've done a lot of thinking on the implications of time and what it is and what we mean by that word. And my presentation on time has gotten noticed and exceptionally high marks by people that aren't confused, I would say. First of all, we can understand the difference between the words time and eternity, because these are not the same. The definition of eternity may be somewhat difficult to elaborate, but the definition of time, as we use the word, should be very simple, clear, and straightforward. Since time is included in and affects not only our everyday lives, but also many physical equations or chemical recipes or formulations, a proper definition of time is of the utmost importance. Time is not a thing in and of itself, but in a non-material combination of two things, it would be events in the physical realm and sequence. I think that time is considered somewhat mystical because it is a combination of both of the components that are non-material realities, events and sequence. Well, an event can be a physical reality, but the word in general is applied to an idea or a concept. time is not a thing that anybody can do anything to. It cannot be reified, in other words, into something material that can be modified, that can be stretched or changed. The second premise of the nature and definition of time is that the universe doesn't exist in time, but time exists in the universe because time is events in sequence. We do not measure time. We count time, right?
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense.
We don't take out a ruler and measure it, or we use a replicable sequence of identical events, like the dripping of water for a water clock, or the ticking of a clock, or the vibrations and oscillations of an atom to keep track of time. We count time. We do not measure it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Put it that way. Yep.
Yeah. The sequence of events in the material universe are, most of them, individual micro events on the particle or subparticle level. Think about the almost unimaginable number of electrons, protons, neutrons, and whatever out there in the universe. We don't even know how big the universe is, James. We can't see to the edges of the universe. Every vibration, every wiggle of every particle in the universe is a discrete event, that all of which are in sequence. And so the unimaginable number of these events that form a mosaic or a fabric that we call time, that we set everything significant to us against that background. Back in the summer of 2000, the chief astronomer and director of the U.S. Naval Observatory, the late Tom Van Flandern, and I were over in Italy to give presentations at the annual University of Milano Bergamo Symposium. Both of us were staying up in Bergamo, about an hour's train ride to Milano. One morning, we sat together on the train down to Milano and talked about time. So Tom is the thinker that really kickstarted me to deal philosophically with this subject. He said he thinks about it along these lines. He asked me to imagine there was nothing except empty space with just the faucet in it. The faucet drips. The faucet drips again. So he asked me how much time there was between the drips. And I immediately saw, and we agreed, that the question was unanswerable. There was nothing that we could say. Then he asked me to visualize a second dripping faucet, one that drips 60 times for every time the first faucet drips. Now what can we say? Well, we can now remark about the ratio being 60 to 1 on a regular basis. And then we can add a third faucet that drips 60 times for every time the second faucet drips. So now we can remark not only about the mathematical ratios, but we can now talk about cycles of events within cycles of events and regularity in their relationships. Okay, well, the planets revolve around their central luminaries on a fairly regular cyclical basis, right? That's the basis for our day and night. The annual solar cycle of 365 and a quarter days for the year. Another way of thinking about time is this. Generally, when we heat a chemical reaction, it happens faster, right?
Yes.
Do we think that the heat is evaporating or destroying time? No, we don't think that. Obviously, the heat is just increasing the rate of molecular collisions or interaction events. The big symbol T in any physical equation stands for the number of events during that duration.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, with our, we try to quantify, like you're saying, but that's based on those events, but it has to be in relation to other events or there's no way to, to gauge. We're on the same, we're on the same page, but I love this stuff.
So let me quickly add, something about Einstein making space and time relative and developing what's called space-time. What utter nonsense. Space is just a mathematical construct, and time is the sequence of events. Neither one can be reified. The universe cannot be infinite in size. It must be finite, and instead of indefinite space projected out along the Cartesian coordinates, the universe has a certain finite volume to it. Poof! There goes Einstein's theories of relativity. They're useful in many cases, but they're not ultimately correct, and Einstein never accepted or became comfortable with his own thinking.
Well, and that's, you know, again, I think that comes down to, you know, as far as experimentation and application of things, that's the best way that people feel that they can justify or understand what they're looking at in some terms. You know, when we're talking about, you know, fusion and the atomic bomb and things like that.
It's all mathematical, and Einstein was a genius, but he had a high level of integrity, and he always was uncomfortable with his own thinking, and we feel like we understand the mistake that he made in positing his relativity theories. An interesting sidelight to all of this is that I can't watch and enjoy movies anymore that deals with time travel because such a thing violates my logic and reasoning on such a fundamental level. Just imagine reality if sequence could be scrambled or reversed.
Yeah.
Would there be any certainty or security at all when anything that ever developed could always be undone by reversing the sequence? Is that even remotely imaginable?
It doesn't totally make sense when you put it that way. And I think...
Nope. Sequence is a non-material or spiritual foundational reality. And our whole human experience and everything depends upon sequence being inviolate.
Yeah, that makes sense to me when you put it that way.
Okay.
When it comes,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that may be known or quantified or maybe unknown is, you know, how many major waves of cataclysm has the Earth endured? And is that as a result of, I mean, you talked about the Grand Canyon, for instance, that would have been, you know, in the EU model from discharge from another planet. Can we get into kind of that concept? And also, like, do we know how many, and is there kind of more coming?
Let me start off by using my favorite phrase, or at least my most common phrase, I don't know. In my opinion, initially the Earth cooled and formed a crust. This crust is relatively thin, 15 to 30 miles, thinner than an onion skin on an onion by comparison, like a huge water balloon. The ocean trenches or basins bear the earmarks of EDM, electrical discharge machining scratches, and I can see them to be EDM'd out while the Earth was still in proximity to its parent, Saturn. So this was maybe a cataclysm before the Earth was populated to form the ocean basin. And then somewhere along the line, you know, a vast amount of water was added to the Earth that filled the ocean basins. And a long sequence of life development phases took place. And the life development sequence actually terraformed the Earth and turned it into a biologically supportable, a life support system. Now, just starting arbitrarily at a point in time when the Earth was in axial alignment with Mars, Venus, and Saturn, then the great deluge or catastrophe that we have to deal with historically in the various ancient records, the Old Testament and other scriptures, called the Flood, that was when we that alignment broke up and we spiraled in to take a new orbit around the, you know, our current sun. But before that breakup, there were also two waves or series of catastrophes or cataclysms that the Earth endured. One of which was Mars bobbing up and down on the polar alignment. And when it came close to the Earth, it pulled up material from the Earth. And then as it receded, that connection broke, and the Earth, the material that was pulled up from the poles, mostly water, but muck, okay, everything that was underneath, trees, rocks, sand, gravel, anything that was alive got pulled up and frozen in the temperature vacuum of outer space. And then when it had collapsed back down to the Earth, then it was super cold and it formed what's called a permafrost. We still have permafrost today. I don't even know how deep it goes. So, but after we spiraled in, or let me say, while we were spiraling in toward a new orbit to around the sun, the orbits of the planets, especially the new planets that were added to the solar system, were on highly elliptical orbits. And the ellipses of the orbits intersected. So we had flyby or intersection, orbital intersection catastrophes with both Mars and Venus. Very, very difficult to sort it all out because all we have is ancient myth.
Yeah, we don't have scientific journals from back then that were logging the events.
Right.
And I think it's very interesting to see how long some of those petroglyphs have lasted. And it's interesting in light of what you were saying, that perhaps those people went to a protected area and were trying to document it.
Yep. They reproduced what they saw, but they didn't take a scientific approach. They were more interested in the meaning of it all and what it had to say about ultimate issues, God. And by the way, if worship is giving credit for the origin and sustenance of life, then in a way, we're all sun worshipers, because our thinking today is that we get the absolute necessary life energy from the sun, right?
True, yeah.
Okay, so that, if you believe that, that makes you a sun worshiper. Doesn't make you an ignorant or, you know, a primitive sun worshiper, but that's sun worship because you're giving credit to the sun for being the origin of the necessary life support energy.
Right.
Well, I don't believe that that energy comes from the sun.
Right.
I believe it comes from outside the sun, and the sun is just a focal point, a transfer point.
So it's one of
that changes the Birkeland current energy into surface nuclear fusion and the generation of sunlight.
You know, that's super fascinating to think, because you're in that equation, you're also not excluding that life itself is may not only be sustained by that, but maybe by God himself. I mean, that's almost what kind of reading between the lines here, what you might be saying is that by using the network of currents, that the way the energy flows, that actually it could be coming from the presence of something greater.
Sure. Not to put too fine of a point on it, I'm a deist. I have never been able to countenance any system of thinking that didn't involve a creator. But all of this electric universe stuff only deals with the issue of a creator. It doesn't really deal with the more important issue of whether that creator is worthy to be considered a god. That is the ultimate issue. Is the creator worthy to be considered as God, or just a creator that doesn't care, that just gets off creating things and throwing them out there and doesn't care what happens to them?
Yeah.
Us, we, me being included.
Well, and as far as that goes, what I'm trying to say is that the model does not exclude God from it.
Absolutely. It doesn't exclude God. It doesn't have anything to say about the issue of God. It only has something to say about the issue of there being a creator.
Right. But coming back to kind of full circle to what you were saying about scientism is that, you know, that it's almost like it has to exclude the idea of a creator to sustain itself. But in this line of thought, that it's not mutually exclusive at all. It actually makes more sense to include it.
Well, and I'm trying to be an apologist for science, because science actually is the child of modern science is the child of Christianity or Christendom. And it developed in an atmosphere of fundamentalism, where the Bible was the inviolate word of God, no matter what we experienced or what we saw in the real world. And so science had to battle shallow or misguided dogma based upon mostly mistranslation or misunderstandings of what Scripture said, but sometimes completely invalid concepts promulgated by Scripture. So science had to separate itself from religion, and the many scientists have undergone a lot of starting with Galileo being one of them, persecution and oppression from the religious authorities. So it's somewhat natural that science has gone too far and tried to conceive a reality that started with the Big Bang. Let me see. In the beginning, there was nothing, which exploded into something that ramified down into me and you having a somewhat intelligent conversation.
Yeah, that the likelihood of that syncing up is pretty, I don't know. It's harder to grasp than a different model being set into motion, you know, something
right.
with intent and with
right.
understanding those different laws.
Yeah, where in such a materialistic view and universe, how do we get the development of the finer dimensions of being a human being, of love and kindness and mercy and compassion and care, romance, ecstasy?
Well, and one that you didn't mention is imagination, you know.
Right, imagination, right.
Conceptualization of something that may or may not exist.
Where does all that come from? From random developments, from an exploding nothing? You buy that, I've got a bridge I want to sell to you.
Well, this gets into a lot of the deeper philosophical and religious tones of things. And, you know, for our listeners, I mean, you know from listening to our show that we're religious, we're seeking a greater understanding of the world around us. And I think this understanding the possibility of an electric universe and its relation to the Earth and then our place in the Earth helps us to gauge and weigh that, to understand things going forward. I think it has a great amount of value. There's still some other things that, you know, we might weigh into the equation, but it's always something that is tickled our fancy ever since we really kind of discovered that a couple years ago and started entertaining that idea from, the Thunderbolts project, which you've been an instrumental part of. So mm-hmm. we want to definitely thank you for being able to challenge kind of the status quo, but also to challenge some of our thinking and to help us expand our horizons or our view on these subjects. So it's always, I feel like we're coming off benefiting much more, but I hope for you, revisiting the subject has been good for you as well.
Okay. The one thing that we didn't deal with in this session was, what about the future? What about future cataclysms? What can we expect to happen to us if time goes on in this world? So
yeah, let's go over that, because that is something that I think most of us really, I guess in the grand scheme of things, reaching into the future, we like to have a positive outcome, but people with a biblical mindset and an understanding of events to come might actually look at our world a little bit differently. And then when you layer in this aspect of the electric universe and some of the things that may have to happen to get to the other side of that, I think that definitely kind of sets it up.
Right. Well, we find ourselves as individuals and as a people, kind of at the bottom of a well, or with the forces of the universe towering over us, the geophysical forces. We can't control the geophysical forces of earthquakes, tsunamis, storms, hurricanes, and the solar system forces tower over the geophysical forces by magnitudes, and the galactic forces tower over the solar system forces by magnitudes. And the intergalactic forces tower over the galactic forces by magnitudes. And we're standing under all of this, pretty much helpless. And so let me hasten to add that at this point in time, I don't know of any developments out there that threaten the Earth and its stability of its environment at this point. So that's the good news. Let me sugarcoat this for you. We have to be concerned about only a half a dozen types of threat that we know of. One would be an asteroid strike. That could be devastating to an area or even a nation. Number two, a cometary flyby. That could be devastating globally. Three, a CME strike. You know, there are various levels of CME intensity, and a major class X CME ejection hitting the Earth directly would sterilize the surface of the Earth. The sun, we live next to an electrical monster, and it periodically burps out of solar flares and CME ejections. The fourth category of things that we could be wiped out by is a gamma ray burst hit. Various objects, systems out there in the wider universe, discharge a pencil-thin gamma ray burst of incredible intensity. If such a ray hit us directly, it would sterilize the surface of the Earth. Another thing that you could worry about if you were so inclined would be a power surge coming along down the Birkeland current that feeds our sun. And so this would cause the sun to flare up, possibly even to the size of engulfing the Earth. Another concern that we have to have based on what we observe going on out there is a supernova. If one of the stars that were too close to us went supernova, that again sterilizes the surface of the Earth. A large set of other relatively unknown and remotely possible developments we have to consider. For instance, for all we know, the Earth may have already been inductively heated internally in the past, and that heat is slowly working its way out. And we haven't discovered it yet, but it's going to melt the surface of the Earth.
So there's a few ways. I mean,
yeah,
there's seven or eight. Yeah.
Or more ways that we can be wiped off the face of the Earth.
Yeah, and most of the ones that you described, you know, there wouldn't be survivability very, very well. But that also kind of lends credence to, you know, statistically, we've escaped a lot, and we, you know, maybe there's more purpose to why we're here and what this journey includes.
So a lot of people ask the question maybe backwards. they ask, why is God throwing these catastrophes at us, rather than asking the question, how much are we being protected from an all but fatal global catastrophe?
Exactly. And acknowledging that and understanding that,
right,
it takes that humility, but also the understanding.
Yeah. So, the United States has suffered some astral catastrophes. We're always vulnerable to now and then a Tunguska-type event, which could wipe out a major city or even a few if it hit in the right place. Cometary disasters. Comets break up, and the pieces of comets are highly charged, full of energy. They're energy bullets. And for instance, they bring significantly more energy to be dispersed upon the Earth than we like to realize. Even though the comets are all tracked, they can break up, and just a piece can destroy a territory the size of Oregon. This has already happened in what's called the Great Chicago Fire. The name of the disaster, the Great Chicago Fire, is an incredibly misleading. It's the human propensity to be in denial. Thousands died, and the town of Peshtigo got wiped out by electrical discharge, plasma, torch heat, fire from the heavens that melted rocks in places. The memory of this disaster has been buried under the rubric of the Great Chicago Fire and the false fable that it got started by Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over a lantern in a barn.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't think I've even heard of that. So I think
And then another major American disaster was known as the New Madrid earthquake, because this catastrophe was always greater and more widespread than citizens of the U.S. are willing to admit. The memory of this great Mississippi disaster of 1812 has been suppressed, buried, and almost completely forgotten. But it can be verified in the historical records. It was undoubtedly caused by a comet influencing the geophysical factors of the region, and the disaster was preceded by almost a year of earthquakes. Blue-green fire ran along the ground. The Mississippi River surged backwards for a time. You can imagine the damage that did to the region. There was electricity in the air. Five whole towns disappeared, got swallowed up by the earth. Some people were swallowed alive by convulsions in the surface of the earth. Some men went mad and fled in terror while abandoning their families. There is no accounting of the number that died. You can read extensively about this American catastrophe in the book, The Earthquake America Forgot.
Well, I can't thank you enough for bringing up some of those. And it's interesting to see, the one that I actually just finished watching the movie Greenland yesterday, and that actually deals with the cometary threat. But also just applying the lens of the electric universe to cataclysm and understanding that. I mean, when you talk about the New Madrid quake and having electrical discharge involved there, like how would you know what we would call modern science explain that? You know, that's kind of, I don't know that it can as well as the EU can.
Yeah, modern science cannot explain lots of things, and the approach is just to bury it, ignore it, work around it, because to a human being, the ultimate thing that we value is our paradigm. Please don't change my paradigm, James. Please don't threaten my paradigm. I can't deal with that. Yeah. If I'm a normal human being, I'd rather die than change my paradigm.
Well, and I think, you know, more on a geopolitical way, that's something that we're also dealing with is paradigm shifting and paradigm correcting and paradigm I don't know how else to put it. Paradigm policing, let's just say.
Yeah, well, the human race suffers from what's called paradigm paralysis. And what for? Come on, let's suck it up and deal with these things.
Well, and that's
rather than pitifully clinging to a paradigm that isn't working, that doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, that's part of what we try to do with our show here is to explore,
sure,
to explore other paradigms to see if they help us understand or even adjust our own. You know, it's paradigm shift doesn't happen overnight for a lot of people. You know, it's an incremental understanding of different topics. So
yeah,
that's part of why we've got you here today. We've got to wrap things up here, but we can't thank you enough for all the insight that you've provided, both philosophical, scientific. You touched on some moral aspects as well. So can't thank you enough for that. Well, is there anything else that you that you'd want to share, or any other questions that you might have? Or I guess we'd like to have you share where people can get a hold of some of your work, some of the things that matter to you most, and give you an opportunity to kind of plug those things.
Well, if you so desire, you can reference the Micomar site, micomar.biz, and if you're really adventuresome, you can reference the ificu.com site.
Yeah, and those are both, we can put both of those into our show description, show notes. And we want to make sure that we point to Thunderbolts as well, because you've been instrumental in getting that off the ground and supporting that as well. So,
right, yeah, I failed to mention that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you will join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.